Welcome to the latest global news, recorded at 03 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 23rd of June. This is Max Pearson with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, after weeks on the run and dozens of deaths, the Jamaicans get their man. Christopher Dudas Koch is under arrest. Also, America's runaway general, Stanley McChrystal, mocked the politicians and now may face the sack. Where would that leave the Afghan mission?
It is truly at the tipping point right now. To fire him would pretty much, in my opinion, put Afghanistan in a tailspin.
Also in this podcast, hard times in Spain. Who'll look after the army of unemployed? And posh London restaurants launch a bring-your-own-wine policy. But be sure to get the right bottle.
It really is very thin and acidic on the palate. It's quite unpleasant, actually.
But first, 76 people were killed when Jamaican police and troops moved into the Tivoli Gardens area of Kingston last month in a bid to flush out Christopher Dudas Koch, who's wanted for extradition to the US on drugs and gun-running charges. Well, now Dudas Koch is finally in detention. And shortly after the news broke, I spoke to Jamaica's Minister for Information with Responsibility for National Security, Daryl Vaz.
The police have conducted a press conference where they have confirmed that Christopher Dudas Koch was held in a police spot check at about 4 o'clock Jamaica time this afternoon and is currently in police custody.
Do we know what happens to him next?
We don't know. It's a matter that the police will have to be in touch with the Director of Public Prosecution, and of course his lawyers will have to indicate what whether or not their instructions are to waive his rights or to conduct the legal process.
But the legal process could involve, obviously, extradition to the United States. Is he also facing potential charges in Jamaica?
The police are investigating that based on the incidents in the recent weeks. But as we know, there is an extradition warrant that has been issued, which now will be effected now that he has been arrested.
The operation to try to arrest him just a month ago resulted in the deaths of 76 people, and it was done in the name of enacting the extradition to the United States. 76 people dead. Was it worth it?
There's an investigation going on in relation to the incident relating to the death of a number of persons. It's too early to say what the circumstances were. There are questions in relation to certain individuals. There have been a number of persons that have been positively identified that were wanted for various charges. So it is early days. What is important is that the government's commitment to fight crime and violence and the criminal gangs continues, and the extradition was only one aspect of it.
But as you know, amongst the supporters of Dudas Koch, and he does have many in the Tivoli Gardens district around West Kingston, there is a very, very bad atmosphere as a result of that operation and the deaths that followed.
Yeah, there is an aftermath, and of course the state is doing what it needs to do to investigate and also to compensate those who feel that they were meted out injustices in terms of damage to their homes, etc. All that is a process, but the fact is that the state is committed to stamp out the criminality that has taken over parts of the inner cities of Jamaica.
This isn't over, though, in a very real sense. Surely Jamaica is now, and your government is reaping the whirlwind of allowing the nexus of politicians and crime bosses and purchasing of favours and votes in slum districts to have festered for so long.
Well, it's actually ironic that as I speak to you, I just came out of Parliament for a few minutes where the debate is going on in relation to a number of crime bills. And in this debate, both the opposition and the governing party, are realizing and taking responsibility that this is not something that started under this administration or the previous. This is something that has been creeping in to the politics in Jamaica for many decades, and there's a commitment on both sides to deal with it once and for all. And I think that's the important part of the lesson that we have learned.
Jamaican Information Minister Daryl Vaz. President Obama is going to face down his runaway general in the White House on Wednesday after a storm of controversy broke over the publication of an article under that banner headline in Rolling Stone magazine. General Stanley McChrystal is commander of international forces in Afghanistan. He's been called back to Washington to explain in person remarks attributed to him and his team in the Rolling Stone article, in which he is said to have been disparaging about President Obama himself, as well as Vice President Biden and others in the civilian administration. The general could be sacked. Certainly, President Obama has made it clear he's angry.
General McChrystal is on his way here, and I am going to meet with him. Secretary Gates will be meeting with him as well. I think it's clear that the article in which he and his team appeared showed a poor judgment, and but I also want to make sure that I talk to him directly before I make any final decision.
One of the man himself, Stanley McChrystal, described by Rolling Stone as that runaway general. An embarrassing article plus furore in Washington, cue the apology. This was his written statement to the press.
I extend my sincerest apology for this profile. It was a mistake, reflecting poor judgment, and should never have happened. Throughout my career, I have lived by the principles of personal honor and professional integrity. What is reflected in this article falls far short of that standard. I have enormous respect and admiration for President Obama and his national security team.
This is certainly a controversy President Obama could have done without. Michael Hastings is the journalist who wrote the profile for Rolling Stone after spending several weeks with Stanley McChrystal and his aides. He's currently embedded with US forces in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar, hence the poor quality of the telephone line. Julian Marshall asked Mr. Hastings what had been particularly notable about his time with the general and his team.
You know, obviously the sort of mocking of the vice president stood out quite clearly. Mocking of Richard Holbrooke stood out quite clearly. Calling the national security advisor a clown who stuck in 1985 stuck out quite clearly. There was a number of things they said from the get-go that usually you don't hear with such candor.
Why do you think they were so indiscreet?
I think you'd have to ask them, but it's something I asked myself throughout the reporting of the trip. That being said, I think there's a number of factors. I think, in general, the past profiles of General McChrystal have all been very, very flattering. So there is a certain complacency with believing that everything they do, every sort of profile will always be flattering. I think that was sort of the sense that they had.
What was General McChrystal trying to get across to you, do you think?
One idea, you know, to try to sort of reach a younger audience with Rolling Stone. I think another idea, clearly there was frustration that he had towards the White House. And I think they wanted to get that out in the open. Perhaps they miscalculated, you know, with what their message would actually impact. But I think if you go and look at the career of General McChrystal, and especially how his team has operated this year in Kabul, you'd see a pattern of wanting to shock the system with various things they do.
I mean, were you surprised that relations between General McChrystal and President Obama himself, at least on the evidence of an aide, seemed to be so bad? After all, this is a man who was personally appointed by the president.
I wasn't surprised at all. I think President Obama is uncomfortable with the military. He doesn't really know the military very well. In this case, President Obama didn't understand necessarily the war in Afghanistan, the military's relationship to that war. The military was coming from a relationship with General David Petraeus and President George W. Bush, so they expected the kind of one-on-one contact to set the precedent. And Obama did not fulfill that precedent. He only spoke to him once in the first few months that he was on the job. President Obama's only visited Afghanistan once after sending 140,000 troops there. So obviously, your commanding general, and if you don't feel like your president is listening to you, that's going to cause frustration, and that frustration is going to seep down through the staff.
Because from the evidence of an aide quoted in your article, President Obama didn't really seem to know who on earth General McChrystal was.
No, he didn't. He had first seen him in a room at the Pentagon a few days after inauguration. You know, when he chose him, he fired General McTiernan to choose McChrystal. He spent 10 minutes at a photo op with him. This is information that McChrystal's people were happy to give me.
Are you regretful that, I mean, it's quite possible that your article could now cost General Stanley McChrystal his appointment in Afghanistan?
I've learned in life that I only have control over so much, and what I have control over is what I write and what I report, and to try to do the best job I can. You know, this is a serious business. War is a serious business. Journalism is very serious. You know, obviously, you try your best to be fair, and I think I did that in this case.
How is the article and the political stink that it's created? I mean, how's that going down in Kandahar, where you are embedded with U.S. troops?
It's actually quite amazing. Once a few soldiers found out that I was the one who had written this article, they actually came up and said, good, because they're not happy with General McChrystal's strategy here at all, particularly with its rules of engagement. One gentleman I spoke to here even pointed me to a wall of graffiti that was expressing that frustration. So the reaction from the troops here, which is widespread, I believe, from all my other reporting that I've done with the military, is that they were not happy with the directive that General McChrystal was pushing down.
Michael Hastings of Rolling Stone magazine. So what will happen to the general when he goes to Washington? For a soldier's perspective, Lawrence Pollard spoke to Troy Stewart, who served recently in Afghanistan and now blogs on military matters.
The interviews he's done, he's been very politically correct in answering those interviews. Is this the way he is behind the scenes? Possibly. He's a soldier. You know, a lot of us cuss and say things and say off-color crude humor that, you know, most normal civilians would not understand. But, you know, if this is the way he normally is, it could be. Their troops don't want to see a politician. They have enough of that as it is. They want a leader who's going to call it like they see it. And I think General McChrystal's comments are fairly accurate. I think he called it as he see it, and maybe he just let emotion and being frustrated get the best of him and say something in front of a reporter that he possibly felt comfortable with.
Do you think that this is, in effect, simply a presentational mistake, or do you think it represents something deeper in the strains between the military and Washington?
Well, I reported on my blog at boohammer.com a while back. I wrote about McChrystal and Eikenberry not getting along, the war between them.
This is the ambassador, the American ambassador couple, yeah.
Yes, Carl Eikenberry. He spent 3 years as a commander in Afghanistan in 2002, 2005, 2006, and I've served under him when I was there. I've blamed him several times. I specifically hold the blame to him of why we are where we are in Afghanistan today.
Now, that's certainly something that emerges from the article. The other thing, of course, that emerges is what could border, I'm not quite sure what the technical definition is, but what could border as insubordination against the commander-in-chief. How do you interpret the attitude of the general, McChrystal, to the commander-in-chief, Obama?
I'd have to go back and look and see if there was another thing, but the only thing I saw that he said about the commander-in-chief was he talked about the first meeting and feeling like the president really wasn't, you know, they met in like the war room or whatever, and the president really was kind of intimidated by all the leadership, and that his heart really wasn't in it, and that the one meeting he had, one-on-one meeting, was like a 10-minute photo op. Hmm. I didn't hear him call the president any names or, you know, descriptive language or anything like that. But of course, you know, somebody's ego and pride. And if you're the commander-in-chief and you know, perception is reality. If he interprets that he was offended and then he could say it that way.
No, but what's he going to do? What's going to happen? Is McChrystal in really, really big trouble? Could he lose his job? And therefore, sort of, you know, what would that mean to the strategy, which, of course, McChrystal is very closely identified with in Afghanistan?
If the reports are true, and these nothing's been confirmed yet, McChrystal has a resignation letter in hand, willing to hand it to the president if that's what the president wants. But I can tell you, that will put the president in a very, very bad situation.
Why?
And I think the president is back is against the wall on this. Because they fired General McKiernan, who was a very effective leader, and I criticize that heavily in my blog because they did it very disrespectfully in the media, and they never gave the guy a chance to prove himself or unprove himself. They put McChrystal in there because they said he was absolutely the best guy in the job. He was the smartest guy, and he had the strategy to do it. Well, McChrystal now has been there just at about 14 months, 15 months, I think. And, okay, he said something. All right, he hurt someone's feelings, or maybe he stepped out of line. But does that warrant firing him at the height of the most deadliest year we've ever had? And it's gotten deadly every year since 2006. But the most deadliest year we've ever had in Afghanistan, in the middle of the summer, the height of the fighting season, when so much is hinging. It is truly at the tipping point right now. There's no way they would recover. Put all the leaders and staff in place and be able to be effective providing guidance to the troops in this summer. And I think the enemy would capitalize on that.
Troy Stewart, who blogs at boohammer.com. The United Nations says Peru has overtaken Colombia as the main producer of coca leaf, the raw material for making cocaine. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime said it was worried by the increase in Peru, where coca production has doubled over the past decade to make up 45% of world supply. From Lima, Dan Collins reports.
The UN has been following the trend for some years, and now Peru has overtaken Colombia as the number one producer of coca leaf. A UN report in 2009 said Peru harvested close to 120,000 tons, while Colombia produced just over 100,000 tons. Colombia has steadily reduced coca production with hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to eradicate drugs crops and fight the rebel groups that profit from them. Its president-elect, Manuel Santos, has promised to continue the policy. In Peru, coca growing has spread to new, remote areas, and remnants of the Shining Path guerrilla group work for drug traffickers. In 2009, drug trafficking generated $22 billion, according to Peruvian government figures, almost 17% of the country's gross domestic product. The contrasting figures will not surprise critics of the war on drugs, who've long argued that squeezing production in one country just makes the traffickers transfer their operations elsewhere.
Dan Collins reporting from Peru. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. As ever, we welcome your comments. The email address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Over the coming weeks, we'll be assessing the impact of austerity measures on economies around the world in a series we're calling Hard Times here on BBC World Service. Spain is one of the European countries worst hit. One out of every five people there is unemployed. As Pascal Harter now reports, families are keeping the country afloat, but for how much longer, as government-imposed austerity measures begin to bite?
Demonstrations against the cuts the Spanish government is making have been taking place across the country.
They are making the working class pay the crisis, which we are not the cause, but we are paying the consequences. They are cutting the economical help for the workers, for the retired people and people unemployed. So we don't think that's a solution, and that's why we demonstrate.
To bring down its massive deficit, the Spanish government is slashing public spending to save over 15 billion euros in 2 years. It's cutting tens of thousands of jobs and shaving an average of 5% off salaries in the public sector. The public doesn't like it.
We are going to see how our salaries are going to be reduced significantly, and this is a big trouble for us.
Could you see conflict and violence here in Spain, like we've seen in Greece?
Yes, I think so. We are having a general struggle for the public sector in some weeks, and I think there will be more struggles like that.
There's around 1,000 people at this protest in Barcelona. There are couples with small children in prams, and there are grandparents, too, upset at the freezing of their pensions. This really is a family protest. Spain is suffering from the highest unemployment in Western Europe. That's 4 million people on benefit, which runs out after 2 years. Spain's biggest union, the Workers' Commission, says the government measures, like freezing pensions, is going to squeeze the family help that 4 million rely on. Dolors Llobet is the union spokeswoman in Catalonia.
The most vulnerable at the moment are the unemployed, especially those who are at the end of their unemployment benefit. When they're no longer eligible for that, then the government gives them 420 euros a month, but only for 6 months. Clearly, you can't live on that. But in Spain, pensioners are using their pensions to help their unemployed children get through this period. Freezing pensions will squeeze that support, and it's the family network that's keeping the country afloat.
I'm going to Pedro's house now, because with 6 out of 7 of them unemployed in his family, I want to know what's keeping them afloat.
Hola. ¿Qué tal?
Right now we're in my house with my mother and my grandmother and my sister who's getting ready to go to college. I've been unemployed for 2 years. I worked in construction for 8, but they sacked me, like a lot of people, because there wasn't any more work. Firstly, I lost my job. Then my uncle lost his job, and my sister lost her job, and my mum too. And we were all unemployed. We even have a mortgage to pay on the bar that my mum owned.
Pedro's uncle is the only one of them to have found full-time work again. Pedro's mum takes whatever she can in the way of cleaning jobs and looking after elderly people, but she says there's not much work, and the clients she has have put her wages down. The failed bar business still has to be paid off, and it's grandma's pension that just about covers that.
Entera, entera para arba.
The whole lot. The whole lot goes on the debt.
What does that mean for your future when you might need that money?
There'll be nothing for my future, just being with them. My future goes on the debt.
Spain's families have shown they know how to suffer together. But for how much longer can they actually survive when one salary and a pension can no longer provide for a family of 7 like Pedro's?
Thanks to families, Spain is still okay. But if the day comes when your family can't help you, Spain will explode.
va a reventar por todos lados.
Pascal Harter with that report, and you can hear more of her in-depth coverage on the Assignment podcast on the BBC World Service website later this week. It's been billed as Africa's World Cup, but so far there's been little to cheer for the African teams, and there was more disappointment on Tuesday when the hosts, South Africa, were knocked out. One big talking point ahead of the tournament, and something which will no doubt be discussed again once it's over, is the fact that most of the African teams, 4 out of 5 there, were coached by foreigners. In the run-up to the World Cup, we spoke to Kina Piri. He's a bit of a rarity, an African manager who coaches his own national team, Malawi.
It is not fair for us as African coaches to not to be given a chance to run our own national teams, because in the first place, as you said, most of us are well-trained. I trained in Britain. So to me, I think it is just because of our own mentality as Africans that we don't believe in our own people. And I'm sure now we should start believing in our own people. The few of us that are taking our countries this time are not doing very badly. We are doing better. And I'm sure it will encourage other countries as well to consider their own people.
Well, that was then. What about now? Julian Keane asked Kina Piri if he still deplores the lack of opportunities being given to African managers.
Yes, I definitely stand by that view, because when we look at the African teams that are participating in the World Cup, it's only one team, which is Algeria, that has got a local coach. Most of them have got foreign coaches. And to make things worse, some of these teams have employed coaches through desperation. The qualifiers were used by their local coaches and other coaches as well. But when the teams didn't do very well in the Africa Cup of Nations, they came back instead of helping the coach to work on certain problems. But they ended up firing those coaches and employing coaches to take them to South Africa and to the World Cup, which I feel was not very fair.
But there is another side of the argument. There are a lot of teams across Africa which have been marred by internal divisions, political interference, cronyism, that sort of thing. If you bring someone in from the outside to coach the team, that is a person who will not be influenced by all of that, who's outside all of that.
Yeah, actually, it's quite true. The only thing is what I blame on our administrators is that they don't have confidence in their own people. But what they end up doing is just firing a coach and hiring somebody, not knowing that even the person that you are hiring may not have the capability also to do better than the previous coach.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, because what a team wants at a World Cup is a coach who has international and tournament experience, and the only way they're going to get that is by getting someone from outside Africa.
I should still give an example of the same guy in the same coach that was fired in Nigeria. The coach has been with the team for some time. He first of all qualified the team in their last World Cup, and then he took the team again after other coaches had failed. They could record him, and he still qualified the team to the next World Cup. Now, what international experience can we talk about? Because the person has done his job well by making the team qualify. That's the first thing. Now, how do you know that this person would fail in the World Cup without trying him?
There's been a lot of talk about how this is Africa's World Cup. Do you think this, in a sense, has been a missed opportunity for the continent to showcase some of its management ability, not just the players, but the coaches and managers?
This is an African World Cup, and we, as Africans, expected a lot of African coaches to be there in this tournament. Because most of these teams that have qualified started with African coaches, and they ended up with foreign coaches. But we wanted to see those African coaches attending this World Cup, because that's where they would have also gained experience. How do you gain experience if you don't participate?
Kina Piri, the manager of Malawi's national football team. Everyone in Britain is digesting the news of Tuesday's emergency budget, which saw the government announce tough austerity measures. However, one group of exclusive London restaurants has already started a scheme to encourage people to continue fine dining. Bring your own wine when you eat out. And when the bring your own bottle or BYO culture hits even Michelin-starred restaurants, you know the financial squeeze really is on, even if they might levy a small corkage charge for the pleasure. So to test just how egalitarian this new scheme is, David Whitty took a bottle along to one of the high-class restaurants on the BYO list, Le Café Anglais. It's run by the food writer Roly Lee, who also happens to be the executive chef and buys every bottle on their wine list.
OK, Roly, do you mind if we cut to the chase right at the beginning and I pull out a bottle of wine from my bag, which I've brought, which I think is drinkable, and you're already looking slightly quizzical. Let me just get out my bag.
I do have a range of quite good wine here, you know.
What's your reaction to that?
I don't provide headache pills, you know.
But it says on the back here, content with meat or cheese.
Happy. It's happy.
Oh, it's happy.
With any meat or cheese. I might cook with it. We might clean with it. There's not much wine value in there.
You do allow people to bring BYO, to bring their own wine. Is that correct? You don't encourage it, let's say.
I don't encourage it, but on occasions, of course, I allow them to do it.
But in these stringent financial times, any way to save money would surely encourage people to come here that might otherwise not be able to afford it.
Of course, we live in stringent times, but restaurants have to survive in stringent times. And what people don't necessarily understand is that the cost of the produce that we provide is only about a third of the price that we sell things to. And that's not because we're profiteering, it's because that the service we provide costs a great deal of money.
We're talking about the service of the staff that we're seeing moving around here in their crisp white shirts and aprons.
And the people behind, picking the beans, shucking the oysters. And in the end, when you bring this in, I'm going to say, well, if you really want to bring that in, that's fine. But I'm going to charge you a corkage fee. I'm going to charge you £15 a bottle.
You see, I've got two counter-arguments to this. One is the fact that it's a screw-top bottle, so therefore corkage does not apply because there's no cork.
But you can call it screwage.
And the other is, I like this wine. The whole issue of the customer...
No, you don't. You're just being provocative and cheap. Do you want to put up a £21 wine on this list against the muck you've brought in? Do you want to see the difference?
Well, yeah, why not? Why not? Yes, let's do that. Just while the wine is getting prepared, I would just point out to our listeners and my editor that wasn't my idea.
Mine has a deeper, fuller colour, and you can see how yours is going pale at the edge.
Right. Just sniffed it. Oh dear, there's a sort of lemon face coming out. You're not happy with that taste.
Well, there's certain bright fresh fruit, but it really is very thin and acidic on the palate, and it's quite unpleasant actually.
There's a proper cork going.
It's got a lovely richness to it, very beautiful, pure fruit character. That flavour, that lovely pureness of fruit, stays with you. That's what they call length.
Right, I'm going to take a sip. It does have a longer taste, you're right. I've never thought of that before.
So there you are, you brought in your cheap muck, and you denied yourself some pleasure for no purpose.
And your final word on the whole BYO scheme, bring your own bottle.
I don't think it's about the economy, this BYO thing. And as I've explained, you know, if you do it to try and save money, you're not hiding to nothing. It's an opportunity for people who do collect fine wine to enjoy it with fine food.
Roly Lee, executive chef at Le Café Anglais, ending David Whitty's foray into the world of fine dining. And that's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast should be available for you to download later on Wednesday.